Welcome to Cabeza de Vaca. Episode 16, Signs and Wonders. I'm Brandon Seal. By the end of 1534, Cabeza de Vaca, Castillo, Dorantes, and Esteban had made their way as far south as the Rio Grande, somewhere perhaps near modern-day Lake Falcón. And they were no longer mere slaves to the hunter-gatherer tribes of South Texas. They had become medicine men, faith healers, and honored guests of the new tribes they met, a marked change from the treatment that they had received for most of their 6 years on the continent up to this point. Of course, the flip side to being medicine men is that they were called upon to perform increasingly challenging cures. First, it had just been some Indians with headaches. Now, it was five crippled Indians with some kind of apparently permanent disability. As an upfront payment for their healing, these five disabled Indians had brought their bows and arrows, items of true inestimable worth to these resource-poor Indians, and they laid them at the feet of Alonso Castillo in particular. To date, it had only been Alonso Castillo who had been asked to heal, and yet he was never quite comfortable with it. In Castillo's case in particular, he was always fearful, quote, that his sins might interfere with his cures, and they would not all work out well, end quote. Of course, maybe it was Castillo's piety and humility that made him such a good instrument for divine healing in the first place. Even so, the four expeditionaries agreed that only God could heal the five Indians now before them. No carnival trick, nothing even that Castillo might have picked up from his doctor father back in Salamanca, was going to save them now. And so as Castillo began his rituals, the other three gathered around him and began to pray as hard as they could. Eliseo Torres, a professor at the University of New Mexico, has actually written a paper comparing the healing techniques of the Narvaez expeditionaries and those of three early 20th century Mexican curanderos, medicine men, if you wish to translate it that way. Curanderismo blends beliefs and practices from both the old Catholic saludadores of Castile and Native American shamans in the New World. Professor Torres gives us examples of some of the techniques used by his three 20th century curanderos. Quote, Don Pedrito would pray, massage the body, and prescribe simple herbal plants, the drinking of water, and the use of mud to rub on the ailment. Niño Fidencio would prescribe herbs, baths, and prayers. And Teresita would also prescribe herbs, baths, prayer, and would use hypnosis, end quote. The other critical ingredient for all of these medicine men and curanderos was faith. In Torres' words, quote, the belief that all healing comes from God makes it religious, as does the concept that a curandero can only bring God's will, end quote. It's no surprise, then, that Professor Torres goes on to call Cabeza de Vaca the, quote, first curandero, end quote. And I bet he's right, that Cabeza de Vaca, Castillo, Dorantes, and Esteban would go on to use many of the same techniques that Professor Torres was cataloging a moment ago. In the case of the five lame Indians in front of them now, we can imagine Castillo taking up his position in front of them and starting perhaps with a prayer in a language that sounded ancient and holy even to his fellow expeditionaries. Perhaps first he asked his patients to make confession. Aside from being a sacrament in the Catholic tradition, it was apparently also a part of many Native American religious practices. Maybe then he massaged the bodies of the afflicted, strategically placed or burned herbs, or offered them water to drink, Eucharist style. Maybe he blew on them, or passed warm stones over them. Maybe he chanted his Our Fathers and Ave Marias over and over, inducing in himself a sort of hypnotic trance. We've got a couple of hours to fill in this scene, so it's really not an unreasonable supposition. Perhaps then, maybe toward the end, he bled his patients a little bit, making small incisions near their pain points, and then cauterizing the wounds with fire. All while his companions, quote, prayed in the best way we knew how, end quote. And then, at that magical liminal moment, just as the sun set, the ritual ended, and Castillo made the sign of the cross over his patients and commended them to God's mercy. But this time, nothing happened. No one was too upset at first. Everyone in this age, new worlder and old, knew that the universe was a mysterious place and that cures didn't always happen instantaneously. The five disabled Indians were then taken away, back to their camps, and laid down and went to sleep. Meanwhile, the expeditionaries continued praying. Maybe they were worried. Cabeza de Vaca says he wasn't. Quote, "As for me, I know to say that I always had complete confidence in his mercy and that he would carry me out of this captivity." End quote. Of course, what else could they do? Quote, "No había otro remedio," end quote, Cabeza de Vaca says. That is, quote, "There was no other way to get these people to help us, or for us to extract ourselves from this miserable life," end quote, "than to perform these cures." The faith of Cabeza de Vaca and his companions is pretty hard for us to make sense of in the modern age, but I think it's worth trying to understand, because I have this idea, correct or not, that whatever belief system that these guys emerge from their experience with has to be a pretty functional set of ideas. Ideas that must have had some independent utility outside of being just lifeless doctrine. And here's where this starts to get a little uncomfortable, because the faith of these four expeditionaries is not just some childlike belief in a white-robed wish-fulfiller in the sky, or in some kind of amorphous idea that all is for the best in this best of all possible worlds. It is, in fact, a very specific faith in a very specific creed. And this kind of aligns with something that Admiral Jim Stockdale, the Vietnam War POW, mentioned in his essays. Quote, "I do not know of a single case where a man was able to erase his conscience pangs with some laid-back pop psychology," end quote. No, it seems that the kind of faith that is really necessary to sustain people in extreme situations like this is a faith in something specific. And in fact, the more demonstrably impossible that specific thing is, the better. This, anyway, is what I've come to believe is what kept the expeditionaries going. How else could they have motivated themselves to get up each morning than to have been holding on to some kind of belief system that told them that no matter how bad everything has gone to this point, there is at least a credible chance that things might go a little bit better today? That despite the fact that the last 10 tribes you've encountered have beaten you to within an inch of your life, this tribe, this next tribe, might not, and that you owe it to them and to your own belief system to give them that benefit of the doubt. I like the way Jordan Peterson says this in his book, 12 Rules for Life. Quote, "Faith is not the childish belief in magic. That is ignorance or even willful blindness. It is instead the realization that the tragic irrationalities of life must be counterbalanced by an equally irrational commitment to the essential goodness of being," end quote. And in the case of Cabeza de Vaca's story, I really want to emphasize something else. His and his companions' faith keeps working for them. Why wouldn't they trust in something that works? Quote, "Come morning, the five disabled Indians all awoke so well and healthy that they went away so energetically it was as if they'd never had anything wrong with them," end quote. Cabeza de Vaca assiduously avoids using the word, but it sure as heck sounds like a miracle just happened. And as you might imagine, word of this miracle caused quite a stir in the Native American communities where they were living. Quote, "Among the Indians, this created great awe, and it reminded us to give many thanks to our Lord and to try to know more fully his mercy, and that from this we might have certain hope that he would liberate us and take us to where we might best serve him," end quote. Word of the expeditionaries' cures spread far and wide, and once again, a wave of sick people came looking for them. Quote, "In all this land, nothing else was spoken of except the mysteries that our Lord God worked through us, and people came from far and wide so that we might cure them," end quote. The four expeditionaries were on a roll. Their first cures a few months ago, back in September or so of 1534, weren't enough to dispel in them the suspicion that they might have just been some kind of fluke or some kind of one-off that their God worked through them, perhaps just to keep them safe for a few months longer. But now, it started to seem like something else was at work. And each successful cure contributed to the expeditionaries' confidence, as well as to the confidence that the natives had in them as medicine men. But remember, too, that here along the north shore of the Rio Grande, the expeditionaries were just a few months and a few dozen miles away from the same Indian tribes who had held them as slaves for many years, and who apparently spoke the same language as the Indians they were living with now. And so how did their old bands react when they heard that their hairy, dirty old slaves were now medicine men? No man is a prophet in his hometown, after all. And sure enough, some of the expeditionary's old masters came south to check out what all the commotion was about. And they brought with them a test. Cabeza de Vaca actually imputes no ill will toward these old acquaintances of theirs when they showed up unexpectedly outside the village. Yet, as we've seen in other instances, even when he's the one being assaulted, Cabeza de Vaca is pretty reluctant to project malice onto other people. Almost as proof of this, Cabeza de Vaca, when he's describing the arrival of these old acquaintances, says that, quote, "they liked me," end quote, which seems a strange thing to say, given that nothing about the treatment he received from them in the previous episodes would suggest this. Especially given that it seems pretty clear to me that they had come to try to expose these medicine men, to put them to the ultimate test of their healing powers. More specifically, they had brought the four expeditionaries a dead man. Castillo refused to try to heal him. As we mentioned, he was always, quote, "a very fearful healer," end quote. In this case, was obviously beyond his capabilities. And frankly, there's really no reason why any of the four should have tried to heal the dead man. Even the Native American worldview probably accepted that medicine men had limits to their powers, chief among which was the fact that you can't bring dead people back to life. For the four expeditionaries to have begged off this case seems to me would have been perfectly reasonable. But Cabeza de Vaca accepted the challenge. And I have to ask, why? Why would he do this? He had so much more to lose by screwing this up. Here's what he says, quote, "I had to go with them," end quote. Hube de ir con ellos, he says in Spanish, using the exact same words of divine compulsion that he had used earlier when describing his need to try to escape from these old masters, even though he knew it meant risking his life. I think the answer, or the suggestion in the text, is that he felt called to do it, even if it was irrational, even if it was risky. And I'll let Cabeza de Vaca take it from here. Quote, "I saw that the sick man we had been asked to heal was dead, because there were many people all around crying, and his tent had already been taken down, which is the sign that the owner has died. And so it was when I arrived. I found the Indian with his eyes rolled back in his head, and without any pulse, with all indications that he was dead. So it seemed to me, and Dorantes agreed. I pulled back the sheet that they covered the dead man with, and as best I could, I prayed that our Lord be served by giving this man health, as well as all others who needed it. Afterward, I made the sign of the cross and blew on him many times. The people around brought me his bow and some ground prickly pears as payment," end quote. But again, nothing happened at first. The dead man just lay there, precisely where Cabeza de Vaca had found him, covered in what was essentially his burial shroud, with his lodge already torn down, a sign that his own people had written him off as dead. Cabeza de Vaca didn't panic. He went off and performed his cures on a few other sickly Indians who were not in nearly so bad a state as the dead man. But after he finished this, he gave away the prickly pears that had been paid to him, and everyone just went back to their lodges for the night, leaving the dead man lying there. Yet later that night, suddenly, some of the Indians to whom Cabeza de Vaca had given his extra prickly pears came running into his camp, extremely animated, quote, saying that the dead man that I had cured in the presence of so many had risen up well and moved around and eaten and spoken with them, and that all that I had cured were healthy and without fever and very happy. This caused great awe and fear, and in all the land, nothing else was spoken of, end quote. And with good reason. This is kind of a big deal, even in a world that believes in magic. These four funny-looking medicine men had just raised a man from the dead. This whole scene cries out for explanation. It's not hard to come up with ways to imagine that the dead man was merely unconscious, perhaps, or comatose or something, even though Cabeza de Vaca anticipates those responses in the text and says that the man had no pulse. Some attribute the expeditionary's cures to trickery or showmanship or some kind of hypnotic healing of purely psychosomatic ailments. And maybe they're right, I suppose we can never know for sure. But I like the way that Professor Andres Resendez says it in his book, A Land So Strange. Quote, "There is no more evidence to support those explanations than there is to support the faith of both the castaways and the natives in supernatural intervention. All we can say with confidence is that this gift of curing, whether real or imagined, allowed the castaways to move toward their deliverance," end quote. And actually, if we read Cabeza de Vaca's text carefully, we can see that the expeditionaries themselves remain pretty awed and a little bit incredulous too as to what was happening. Or at least, it seems to me that they avoid the kind of obvious self-aggrandizement that we would expect after performing such a miraculous deed as raising a man from the dead. I mean, the analogy to Lazarus is pretty obvious to any reader in the Christian tradition, which by extension would make Cabeza de Vaca Jesus in this analogy. But Cabeza de Vaca doesn't reference it, and again, seems to studiously avoid the word miracle in describing any of the cures performed by he or his companions. Maybe he does this just to stay out of trouble with the Inquisition, but I think we might just as easily believe that it came from he and his companions' sincere belief that they were not the ones performing these cures, that they were just the instruments of some greater, more unknowable force. And there may be a tactical explanation here, too. You don't have to think too hard to see the advantage of loudly proclaiming yourself to be merely the instrument of the divine rather than the divine itself. As the example of Jesus shows, claiming yourself to be divine can get you killed. But killing the instrument of the divine is a riskier thing, something that could boomerang back on you in unforeseeable ways. And lastly, the four expeditionaries put another clever twist on their practice as medicine men that made the people around them want to see them succeed. That is, they gave away everything that their patients brought to them as payment. If the expeditionaries had simply kept all the bows and arrows and prickly pears and, quote, flint stones as long as 1.5 palms, end quote, or tried to sell them off for some personal benefit, it surely would have made them targets of resentment. Instead, the expeditionaries came to realize that they could reinvest these payments in the people around them and thus attach entire communities to their success. The healing of the 5 disabled Indians, the raising of the dead man, and the subsequent fame that followed led to a marked reversal of fortune for 4 men who just a few months ago were on the brink of daily starvation. Now, quote, all those who heard of our fame came looking for us so that we might heal and bless their children, end quote. Soon, Dorantes and Esteban had to be recruited as healers as well to assist Castillo and Cabeza de Vaca in attending to all the people that were demanding their services. Quote, and no one that we cured did not say that he felt better, end quote. And here's one more. Quote, all left, the happiest people on earth, having given us the very best of what they owned, end quote. For 8 months, into the summer of 1535, the 4 expeditionaries remained where they were, camped there on the north side of the Rio Grande, performing their cures and building their retinue. Their goal was still to get to Panuco, near modern-day Tampico, the northernmost point of new Spanish settlement on the American mainland. And they knew they needed to get moving, but until the prickly pears blossomed again, the land couldn't easily support their movement. And there was actually another reason to try and get moving sooner than later as well. Rumors had begun to circulate through the countryside of evil, bearded medicine men wandering around, taking natives' possessions, inflicting mysterious wounds on them, and disrupting their traditional religious ceremonies. Indeed, these evil bearded medicine men sounded suspiciously like the 4 expeditionaries. And wasn't it strange, some started to whisper, that these medicine men showed up right around the same time as the diseases that they professed to cure? One man's faith healer, it seems, is another man's witch doctor. On the next episode of Cabeza de Vaca. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and think this is a story worth sharing, please tell one friend. And if you haven't already, please go rate and leave a review for us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out the webpage associated with this episode on therivardreport.com, home of nonprofit journalism for a better San Antonio. Editing for this episode was performed by Susana Canseco, sound engineering by Stephen Bennett. The music for this series is entitled Apache and was composed by Kevin Graham and is available on Soundstripe. A special thanks to Father David Garcia, Dr. Frank de la Teja with the Texas State Historical Association, to Steve Davis, curator of the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University, to Professor Andres Resendez at the University of California, Davis, to Dr. Carolyn Boyd with the Shumla Archaeological Research and Education Center and also Texas State, and to David Dunham with Texas Monthly for all their support and suggestions, You'll hear more about them throughout the season. And for more information about us and our other projects, you can check out our website at www.brandonseal.com.